I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the present and future of the labor movement. A new book, If We Can Win Here, The New Front Lines of the Labor Movement, details the ways that challenges before working people have changed and how labor unions are evolving to meet those challenges. My guests will be the author of the book, Fran Quigley, and Lynn Murphy, a food service worker and union steward for Unite Here. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the present and future of the labor movement. There's a new book out called If We Can Win Here, The New Front Lines of the Labor Movement. My guests include the author, Fran Quigley, and Lynn Murphy, who is a food service worker and union steward for Unite Here. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thank you.
It's good to have you both here. A couple of things I need to do. I need to do my sort of standard disclosure here. At one time, Fran and I overlapped as executive directors of what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union. So there's a relationship there. And I also would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Fran, I'm going to start with you on this. Talk to me a little bit about how this book came about.
Sure. My day job is I work at IU McKinney Law School here in Indianapolis, and I teach a couple of different courses. But the main duty I have is I teach in a law school clinic. So the students take on their first cases representing clients. And in my clinic, the students represent workers, mostly low-income workers. And these are folks who are predominantly in the service sector industry. Unfortunately, the reason we represent them is because they've been victimized by wage theft or fired for unjust causes or had some other issues. And then in February of 2012, I realized that a couple things were happening are really within a half mile of where our law school clinic was sitting were a terrific microcosm of what was going on nationally. Is that in February of 2012, the Right to Work law passed the Indiana General Assembly, and it was fiercely resisted by organized labor as we knew it, and it had been constituted for decades, but that resistance was not successful, and the Right to Work law did pass, making Indiana the first state in the Rust Belt to adopt that law. But at the same time, literally on the same day that the Indiana Senate passed the Right to Work law, food service workers at IUPUI on our campus voted to create a union for the first time and voted to approve a contract that increase their wages, increase their benefits, increase their job security. So at the same time, traditional labor was really taking it on the chin at the State House in a much quieter way, just about a mile or two away from the State House. Service sector workers were organizing successfully and making their jobs better. And I realized that was something that was happening nationally and that Indiana had a story to tell.
Lynn, how did you get involved in all of this?
Well, it started when two people came to my door where I was staying at, and they knocked on my door, and I was like, "Who is it?" And they said, we're here to talk to you about your job and how you can better your job." And I listened to them, and they told me how I can better my job and what we had to do because we were underground for a long time. So they was talking to everybody, but no one could talk to each other. For about a year.
Where were you working?
At this time, I was at Butler.
Okay, at Butler University. So you were in an academic environment as well. And when you say they came and knocked on your door, who were the folks who came and knocked on your door?
The union.
The union?
Mm-hmm.
And were you a hard sell or an easy sell?
I was a hard sell because I ran from them. I didn't even join until after they started. So it was like 2 years passed, and when they went around again to ask everybody to sign, that's when I signed right then and there.
And what prompted you to sign? I mean, what were the conditions that led you to think that organizing as part of a union would be the best option?
Well, I already knew about a union because I was in one, but it didn't dawn on me at that time because I was going through some changes at that time because we had just got laid off and we couldn't get unemployment no longer. So my mind was just spinning, you know, to where I was like, I wasn't thinking. So that's what really prompted me. And then I thought about it. I was like, oh, yeah, the union. Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and see what they're talking about. And that's when I decided to go ahead and sign in.
And Fran, you in your book, you use the point there where you're talking about right to work as sort of, I mean, almost as sort of the last battle of the old war rather than, you know, the first battle of a new one, that union structures have to change and the whole idea of a labor union itself is beginning to look for new models. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think that one of the ways, especially we in Indiana and throughout the Midwest, think of labor unions is we immediately think of them connected to manufacturing industries and manufacturing jobs. And that's been the traditional strength of the labor movement, especially in our part of the country. And as we know, those jobs are leaving and have left, and we have lost tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs right here in Indiana, or in Indianapolis, much less throughout places like Muncie and Anderson and across this state. But those jobs have left. For the most part, they're not coming back. It doesn't appear to be, at least in the same way. But what we do have is we have other jobs available, and the other jobs are service sector jobs. The economy in some ways has been shifting from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. And so jobs like Lynn's job and her colleagues' jobs in food service and in maintenance and in security and home health care, those jobs are available. They're just not very good jobs yet. And so the labor movement is pivoting to pay more attention to, understandably and I think appropriately, the type of work that Lynn is doing as opposed to just what the work is out at Allison or at a Delco plant, something like that.
Lynn, when Fran said they're just not very good jobs yet, you shook your head rather violently.
Because so, it's true.
Because it's true. Okay, what makes it true?
Well, I mean, for instance, the job that I worked before we had the union, I was doing five or six jobs, and at a small amount of pay, like $7.25 an hour. Okay. Five jobs. That's not, you know, right.
What were the five jobs?
Cashiering. I was stocking. I was ordering. And I was also cutting up fruit, putting them in the cup, putting them on the shelf, putting stickers on them.
Okay.
You know, so that's like five jobs right there.
And that was one of the issues is all of that. You've already mentioned the fact that it was low wage at $7.25, which is the federal minimum wage.
Yeah.
Were you able to get 40 hours a week out of that? And did you get benefits? Did you get health care or any of the other things that?
Yes, I was, but it was high. Mm-hmm. It was something that I couldn't afford because of the wage that I was making. So I couldn't afford it.
Okay. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the present and the future of the labor movement. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So, you know, that most of the drama with the labor movement has been a lot of the stuff about the sort of the declining membership of traditional unions. And that was right to work to some degree. Yeah. Now, even some of the education reform stuff is about breaking down teachers' unions and all of that. One of your book's theses here, really, Fran, is that sort of a new labor movement is emerging, and it looks to different models than the, you know, different inspirations than the traditional labor movement. You know, some of those are the civil rights movement and all of that. Could you speak to the way this new labor movement is different from the old one?
Absolutely. I would say one thing just to clarify from my perspective is I think a lot of it is derived from the strength traditions of the traditional labor movement. In some ways, the transition from the manufacturing to service economy we have has been predated by 80, 90 years ago when we transitioned from agriculture to manufacturing. And in that instance, those jobs were bad jobs. They were dangerous, low-paid, tenuous jobs, not a whole lot better than what Lynn's describing a lot of the service sector jobs were. And the labor movement and labor movement pushing and workplace organizing and politically leading to the New Deal, et cetera, changed those jobs. So a lot of that legacy is what service sector workers are trying to follow now. But to your point, the model is a little bit different in a lot of settings because the jobs are different in that folks are pretty tenuously employed at maybe working 15, 20, 30 hours at a fast food restaurant or a retail place. There's really high turnover at locations like that. And so something like the fight for 15, the push for $15 an hour wages for fast food workers and retail workers and even home health care workers now and child care workers, that recognizes that it's going to be difficult to create a traditional union. It's not a UAW plant where everybody goes in and works at the same place in huge numbers and you can create a big local that is going to govern the workplace there. So it's a little bit more of a challenge. And frankly, for the labor movement, it's a challenge to figure out how to create, you know, dues-paying local organizations. Where Lynn and her colleagues work at Unite Here is a little bit different. It's a little bit more like the traditional labor union in that they, at the workplace at Butler and at Marion and IUPUI in the airport, they do have one place where they all go into work and they have a local that that helps govern the workplace and negotiate the contract.
How did you choose the places that you were going to feature in the book?
There's a lot going on in town, and frankly, not a lot well covered. It's not been very well covered in town, but Lynn and her colleagues organized the union at Butler. They work for the food service contractor Aramark, and on IUPUI's campus, food service workers again work for the contractor at the airport. Marion, all this work was going on. All the action was going on. At the same time, Service Employees International Union, SEIU, has been trying to organize janitors and security guards and home health care workers. So it's happening. It's just frankly not well understood by the community. So we appreciate the chance to, you know, talk about it on the show, and hopefully that's part of what the book will do.
Lynn, what is the biggest challenge? You know, you're a union steward of pulling people together. And getting them to see the value of belonging to a union?
Oh, the biggest challenge is that they don't understand what a union is, so I have to sometimes make them understand what a union really is and what we really do for them so they would understand, so it wouldn't be as hard for them not to understand as far as our coworkers.
Well, say I'm someone who works in the field that your union would represent, mm-hmm. that I'm a food service worker, whatever, and I'm kind of on the fence. I don't know whether I want to belong or not. Talk to me as if I were that person and try to, as if I would be the kind of person who would join the union.
Okay. I would ask you, what do you want out of this? If you had a bigger wage, what would you do with that? You know, if we was making this amount and, like, say, for instance, we was making $10 an hour, what would you do with that besides, you know, coming to work and, you know, you maintaining as far as your family? What would you do with that? You know, how would you expand that? And
how basically it's about shifting the conversation then to the other person and getting him or her to understand the benefits. And as if I were to say then, for example, well, you know, I'd like to move, you know, my family into a nicer place to live. Yeah, I'd like a nicer apartment. Where do you take the conversation then? And by the way, if I say something like that, am I 80% sold?
Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. Okay. Because you still have to go deeper than just you want to move into a bigger place.
Okay. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the present and the future of the labor movement. We're talking with author Fran Quigley, who is the author of If We Can Win Here, and Lynn Murphy, who is a food service worker and member of or union steward for Unite Here, which is featured in the book. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the present and future of the labor movement. My guests are author Fran Quigley, who's also a clinical professor of law. He is the author of If We Can Win Here, The New Front Lines of the Labor Movement, and a person who is featured in the book, Lynn Murphy, who is a food service worker and the union steward for Unite Here. We've gotten an email question from a listener, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. This is from Book Mamas. It says simply, Book Mamas is proud to carry Fran's books, and we even have some signed copies. So the book came out, what, just a little bit more than a month ago?
Correct.
And what's the reception been so far?
It's been really good. I appreciate the little plug from Book Mamas. We actually had a nice, I would say, a more of a panel discussion than a book launch at Book Mamas a few weeks ago. And Lynn and some of her colleagues at Home Healthcare Workers and a former IUPUI food service worker, and Lynn and some of the union organizers all had a chance to talk about their challenges and what they think the future could be like for working people here in Indiana.
Lynn, I want to go back to the conversation we were having right before the break, where I'm that worker who is not yet sold on joining the union. What are generally the reasons that people advance for saying they don't want to be part of the union, or they're concerned about being part of the union?
Majority of the time is they can't pay the dues.
Can't pay the dues.
The union dues, you know, that's majority.
What are the union dues for Unite Here?
For Unite Here, for full-time, mm-hmm. it's $36.20 a month.
A month? Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhere between, if my math is still good, about $440 a year then total.
Yeah.
Which for, if you're making $10 an hour, that's pretty much a week's pay, right?
Yes.
So are there other reasons if it's other than the dues?
Sometimes they're scared of the boss that they're going to get fired.
That's the one I wanted to draw.
Yes, they're scared because they're scared that the boss is going to fire them. So.
And how often does that happen, Fran? I mean, you document some stories in the book.
Right. It happens far too often. And unfortunately, it's a pretty predictable result of the current state of our labor law in the United States. I've had someone describe it to me, which I think was a terrific way of doing so, is that if a company is upset that workers are trying to organize a union and the company decides they want to fire the workers who are leading the organizing effort, they can do so. And those workers can file an unfair labor practice complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. They can eventually get their jobs back, probably eventually get back pay. But by that time, oftentimes the union has been crushed. And the analogy is that essentially the company has the ability to it was akin to going into my home and stealing a TV set and taking that TV set and just watching it for 2 or 3 months, waiting for the court process to go through. And then eventually the worst thing they have to do is give me back my TV set. No real penalty. So the laws actually make it almost illogical for a company not to discipline and even fire workers who try to form a union. So it's really rough out there.
gotten an email question from our regular listener, longtime listener, Jerry, who says, all except for the relative few on the right-wing fringe of American politics appear to agree that a legally mandated minimum wage is a good idea and that the current federal minimum wage is inadequate to support a family. The big argument between conservatives, which he puts in quotes, and liberals, which he also puts in quotes, has come down to quibbling over a specific amount. The right wants to hold it to $10 or so, and the left wants to go as high as $15. This argument may soon be resolved by right and left agreeing upon a number. However, I have long opined that what would most help the working poor is a maximum wage, or more precisely, a maximum compensation law that would limit the maximum compensation for the best paid employee of the enterprise to 20 or 30 times that of the lowest paid employee. Those members with the actual power to impact compensation levels would thereby have an incentive for increasing compensation for everybody. We should observe that the compensation for government employees has consistently remained well within such limits. Fran, what do you think of that idea?
I think Jerry's on to something, and he's not the only one saying that, because you look at the gap we have at the national level, and definitely in the state of Indiana and the city of Indianapolis, the gap between the rich and the poor is one of the highest we've seen since before the Great Depression. And a lot of that is exacerbated by the fact that folks at the very highest level are getting paid huge amounts, and folks who are doing the maintenance work, who are doing the food service work, or doing the security guard work are getting paid very poorly, much lower than they even were paid in past generations proportionally. So right now the average ratio between a CEO wage in a Fortune 500 company and the average worker wage is 300 times. It's much, much higher than it's ever been before.
And that is not the case in other economies around the world.
It's not.
The gaps are significant, but I don't think we're the outlier there.
Absolutely. It's not been the case in prior generations in the U.S. That's hugely higher ratio than we've seen in prior generations and even 10 years ago, 15 years ago in the U.S. It's gotten out of control at the top while workers at the bottom have stagnated.
We are talking about the present and the future of the labor movement here in Indiana and in the United States. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Ernie, welcome to the program.
Did you say Ernie?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay, that's me. Hi.
Hi.
Nice program. Nobody, even on this program, nobody and everybody's seems to know a lot about the issue, but I've never heard anybody talk about the people that freeload off the union when it represents in a right to work state. They have to represent everybody, even they pay into union dues or not. And if they get disciplined and the union don't take it to arbitration, they can sue the union. So the union has to quit and move on. And nobody brings that up about freeloading. And everybody that you talk to on the radio shows, they all talk about getting something for nothing, freeloaders, like welfare, and not corporate welfare, but anybody that's trying to feed their family is terrible and should be probably locked up if they had their way, but and pay $30,000 to a corporation to hold them a year. That's what they'd like. Okay, so that's my comment about, is there such a thing as Taft Hartley, and they have to represent everybody, whether they belong to one or not, whether they're paying union dues? Thank you. That's my comment.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you very much for the call and the question, Ernie. I'm going to give both of you a crack at that one. I think, though, Lynn's the one who's chomping at the bit to speak to that. She's practically leaping out of her chair. So, Lynn?
Yes, we do represent the ones that what we call them non-bargaining. Those are the ones that's really not in the union, but we still have to represent them. They're still human, too. So we still have to represent them. So,
and you know, obviously, he's making some reference to right to work here. We probably, Fran, do you want to talk a little bit about the significance of the right to work battle, since it was one of the kind of springboards for your book too. The fact that you had that one thing going on with the other movement at the same time.
Right. Well, Ernie said it well. I mean, the right to work law has created in Indiana, and it's been passed in several other states, and including Michigan and Wisconsin, since Indiana became the first state in the Rust Belt to pass it. a free rider problem, in that folks like Lynn, who's a union steward, she is obligated to represent her coworkers who choose not to pay union dues, whether they choose not to pay union dues or not. And so they benefit not just from Lynn's advocacy within the workplace, but they benefit from the raises. The idea, the reason that workers will pay their dues is because they get more in raises from the union contract than they would that they pay out in dues. They get more benefits. They get more job security. And the job security in particular is really important in a place like Indiana, where our law school clinic, we represent folks who are not in a union, and they get fired at will. It's an employment at will state, and they get disciplined at will, and they unfortunately get subjected to having their wages taken from them unlawfully, but it's difficult to resolve that. Those kind of things don't happen in a union shop where you have an advocate like Lynn there as a union steward. And folks in Indiana now are allowed to benefit from all that in the workplace without having to pay the union dues. That was very consciously designed to hurt the union's bottom line, and it has hurt the union's bottom line.
The arguments at the time, because I was covering the issue, and we actually did do a couple of shows at the time on right to work. You know, the Chamber of Commerce and other groups that were pushing for right to work made the argument that this would free companies to respond to market pressures more effectively, and that long term would create jobs. The argument on the labor side was, in effect, well, yeah, but it's going to depress wages. And to some degree, you know, at least if you look at take just a glance at the numbers, there's some evidence that both may have been true. I mean, we are seeing job growth here in Indiana, but they tend to be those, those low-wage jobs that don't provide, a livable standard of living. And, you know, I guess how do we get past that kind of impasse and move this discussion toward not just saying, okay, we're going to create more jobs, but create more jobs that are likely to allow people to live. Uh-huh. Fran, I'll start with you, but then Lynn, I want you to take a crack at that one too.
Sure. I think Lynn said it very well when she talked about her reaction when she ultimately decided to join the union, which was that I have this job and I want to turn it into a good job. Rather than to leave this job and constantly look for a better job and a better job and a better job when they're not out there, let's take in each individual workplace and make them better jobs. And that's what the union movement has been successful at doing historically, and that's what the union movement, especially here in town with Unite Here and SEIU and some workplaces, have been able to do. But for a lot of folks, that doesn't work as well because their workplaces are very tenuous, and they work at McDonald's or they work at Walmarts or places like that are very fiercely resisting the union. So that's when the union movement and folks who support workers like Lynn turn to things like raising the minimum wage, to the Affordable Care Act, where folks can get affordable health care, even if, as Lynn said, they're in a workplace where they, at least on paper, have health insurance offered to them, but it would soak up 50% of their take-home pay. So having legislative responses like raising the wage floor and providing health insurance and benefits like that for all workers, regardless of whether they're in a union or not, is part of the response to that. But Lynn, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Fran.
You're exactly right. The data show we've got a lot of jobs in the state of Indiana. They're just not, especially the ones that we're adding, are just by disproportionately not very good paying jobs that people can't support families with.
Lynn.
Yes, I agree with Fran on that because it's hard for me. You know, I'm still struggling a little bit. So it's not that I'm on the top P's and Q's because I'm in the union. It takes time and process. So, you know, that's what I'm doing. I'm going step by step. But before that, before I even wanted to even quit Butler and just go find another job because I was so fed up, I wanted to stand there and fight first for the next person that comes in.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the present and future of the labor movement. Springboard for our conversation is a new book, If We Can Win Here, The New Front Lines of the Labor Movement. My guests are Fran Quigley, who's the author of the book, and Lynn Murphy, a union steward for Unite Here, which is featured in the book. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. We've got an email from a previous show guest, Derek Thomas, who says, how are workers able to bargain in an age in which employees are increasingly separated from their employers through contracting, subcontracting, and sub-subcontracting, etc.? Fran, I'll start with that one, but Lynn, I also want to hear how you just logistically try to handle that challenge.
Well, I will give a little plug for Derek, as you said, has been on the show before. His Indiana Institute for Working Families, where he works, is just an amazing resource for data on the challenge faced by workers here in Indiana. So their website, I assume, is IIWF.org. But if Google that institution, Indiana Institute for Working Families, a lot of this anecdotal information we're talking about is really broken down beautifully into numbers there.
Yeah, and some of the numbers I just threw at you about the increase in the jobs, but the were numbers provided by his most recent study.
Right. And so to answer the question, it's very difficult for traditional labor unions to organize in a place, as Derek said, whether the subcontractor or the subcontractor or the subcontractor. And we deal with that with a lot of our clients in the clinics who have been labeled as independent contractors when, in fact, they're employees. But that makes it another layer of difficulty for them to organize into traditional labor unions. So while not abandoning the effort to organize traditional labor unions in workplaces like Lynn's and at IUPUI and the airport and other places, the labor movement has turned to these other efforts like raising the minimum wage, like to requiring paid sick leave. That's not worked at the national level very successfully yet, but at the local levels, it has. There's 140-plus communities that have passed living wage ordinances to raise their wages above the minimum wage. 29 states have passed minimum wage laws to raise their wages above the minimum wage. And as we even saw just a few weeks ago, Hamilton County has decided that they're going to make sure they pay all their government workers at least $13 an hour if they're full-time workers. That's the kind of piece-by-piece remedy that's being addressed now, because traditional workplace organizing can be a challenge in some of those workplaces.
And Lynn, how do you deal with that when you try? You know, part of the challenge, I would think, is trying to figure out who you're negotiating with, who's on the other side of the table.
Mm-hmm. Well, I try to. I can't really explain it, but I'm gonna try to. With management, it's hard, but we have in our contract at work where we can sit down and talk with management once a month about the issues and everything that's going on in our work environment. So I go around and I ask all the coworkers, is there anything that you need for me to know before I go in this management meeting? And they'll tell me yes or no.
We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named Gary, also a regular listener. And Gary says, I have worked in union companies and the state and have not been employed since 2009. Additionally, my first semester GPA in graduate school was 4.0. What can a reasonable person do? Fran.
Gary, I'm sorry to hear about your struggle. Again, that's not he's certainly not alone in trying
too,
to find
Gary.
Trying to find meaningful, well-paid work. And I think that Lynn and others would answer the question is that if you can find a job and it's sometimes not a great job, then try to make it a good job. And making it a good job sometimes means organizing a union in the workplace. There are labor organizers throughout the community who are interested in talking with folks. Sometimes it means getting together as something like the Indiana Worker Justice Center, which is new, and trying to help organize workers who are not in a union to push for better treatment at the workplace, push for minimum wage laws, push for better access to health insurance, things like that.
What efforts does Unite here make to help people who are out of work find their way back into the workforce? Lynn?
Well, they start out by telling you, you have a voice, you know, and hey, if we can get one at a time to talk with them and tell them our stories on what we've been through, because we've been there in their shoes. So we try to let them know that, hey, this is our story and this is what we've been through. So we know what you're going through. And what we did was we stood up and we fought.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the present and future of the labor movement. My guests are author Fran Quigley and Lynn Murphy, a food service worker and union steward for Unite here. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the present and future of the labor movement. There is a new book out called If We Can Win Here, The New Front Lines of the Labor Movement. My guests are the author of the book, Fran Quigley, who's also a clinical law professor, and Lynn Murphy, a food service worker and union steward for Unite Here, which is also featured in the book. We've gotten an email from a listener named Mike. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. And Mike says, you mentioned right to work. Job growth is not a useful measure. It is a red herring. Rate of job growth relative to normal states is what matters. Indiana is creating jobs, but is Indiana creating jobs faster than non-right to work states? Valid point, Mike. Thank you very much. Fran, I'll throw that one to you first.
Mike, I would refer you back, as we mentioned before, to the Indiana Institute for Working Families website, which gives that analysis. My understanding is that Indiana, we are doing a pretty good job relative to other states in terms of job creation. We are not doing a good job in terms of reducing the inequality gap. We actually have our wage gap nationally is at a level that's been as disturbing as we've seen since before the Great Depression. And in Indiana, we have one of the fastest growing wage gaps. So again, as we've already discussed, these jobs are being created, that there are jobs out there. There are folks who are hiring, but they're oftentimes 25-hour-a-week jobs for $8, $8.50 an hour. And those are jobs that folks can't support a family on.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about the labor movement today and in the future. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Carol, welcome to the program.
Hi there. I'm originally from Connersville, Indiana. I'm the daughter of a union steward and working at a factory in a climate where unions were an important part of Indiana. And now I see some advances made at places like Butler and IUPUI for service workers. And I'm an adjunct faculty member, and we're fighting sort of the same battle in that, you know, we are underpaid and overworked. And I wonder about the possibility of the natural allies for service workers like adjunct faculty that can make gains in places that are more friendly to workers, like at learning institutions, as opposed to big corporations like McDonald's or Walmart.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Kara. Well, I'll throw that one to Fran first, but Lynn, I'm going to give you a shot, too.
Sure. Carol, this is a common phenomenon across the country, as you know, that adjunct faculty are being leaned on more and more by institutions like the ones where I work, not so much at the law school, but definitely Indiana University as a whole, IUPUI, and a lot of other institutions. And as you mentioned, a lot of folks don't realize that the person standing up in front of a classroom sometimes is getting paid something around poverty wages and is bouncing around from a lot of different places in order to try to make ends meet. So as you would imagine, a lot of those workers, teachers, faculty members from across the country have been connecting with unions, have been organizing in the workplace, and some of them have been able to negotiate favorable contracts. It's been a struggle. But as you mentioned, I think Carol mentioned the point of how this is a relatively receptive setting in a university setting. And that is, you know, where Lynn works, where IUPUI food service workers and Marion University food service workers, they have found strength around the country by being a part of a community where students oftentimes are supporters of the workers, faculty members are oftentimes supporters of the workers, and sometimes the union organizing has been really successful on a university setting where it's been more difficult in places like a hotel or a traditional manufacturing-type workplace.
Was that the situation at Butler, that the students and others were supportive of your efforts to unionize?
Oh, they were great because we got the students involved. We even got the community involved. We got the Butler staff involved. Even the president of Butler helped us to organize us all, you know, and it was beautiful. So getting your community and getting the students involved, it's what you want to do.
We have gotten a follow-up message from presumably, I've just got the first name, but I'm guessing it's Derek Thomas, who says via Facebook, and if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI, says Kentucky is not a right-to-work state, yet manufacturing growth is stronger there since Indiana passed right to work. I've also gotten an email from Elizabeth saying, do you have any comments about the nurses attempting to unionize in the downtown academic centers in Indianapolis? Fran.
In response to Elizabeth's point, I am not familiar with that effort, but I know that it's going on. That is actually a pretty good example of some of the workplaces that are unionized in some other states, in Illinois in particular. Hospitals and nurses are unionized, places like California. We haven't seen a lot of that in Indiana. So it may be an example of how some of these jobs are being now more attractive to the union movement, and some of those workers who are facing difficult situations in the workplace are more interested in being open to organizing in a union.
We are talking about unions and the labor movement here on No Limits. Casey, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Paul. My question is, well, recently I read on Facebook that nationwide there are over 2 million jobs that are available, and the person who posted it was a conservative who said that people just don't want to work and pointed to the evidence that there were 2 million jobs that were unfilled. And my question is, where are those jobs, and why are they so difficult for people to find and to land? And how many of those jobs are full-time jobs that could support a family? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Casey. Well, either one of you, Lynn, Fran.
I'm going to let Fran take it.
Okay.
Well, and Lynn can tell about this from personal experience, and a lot of other folks can too, but we have a lot of clients who say, yeah, there's a lot of great jobs out there. I've got three of them, and I wish that one of them would allow me to support my family. And three of them together still don't quite make ends meet. We definitely have that problem, Casey said, it's a problem for individual families, but it's also a problem for our communities. It's a problem for our state, because folks who are bouncing around from different jobs making $9 an hour are not able to put money into the economy. When the minimum wage is increased, and it's been shown time and time again in studies, you'd think if you raise the minimum wage, it's going to reduce the number of jobs in a community, because Econ 101 would say you raise the price of something, you're going to have less demand for it. But in truth, what has happened and been shown again and again is that if you raise the minimum wage, if folks get paid better, the jobs in the community actually go up because there's a lot more economic activity in the community. If somebody makes, as Lynn was saying, some of her colleagues, if they're making $8, $9 an hour, if they start making $12, $13, $14 an hour, they're spending that money in the local community. It's helping boost the local economy. These jobs that get paid, as Casey said, maybe 20 hours a week, 25 hours a week, $8 an hour, those are folks that are having to turn to public benefits like food stamps, like Medicaid, in order to support themselves. Those employers are relying on our taxpayer dollars to subsidize their business model, and that's not good for any of us.
Well, and what does it do to that classic market-driven argument there? I mean, in theory, if those jobs are going unfilled, shouldn't that drive the wages up on them, according to the thinking, to attract people to fill them? But that doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, it does seem to be that I actually heard recently that some of the very recent economic data nationally has shown some creeping up in wages. And so hopefully that's where this will go. But it does seem like folks are desperate enough that they will take the job getting paid $8.50 an hour for 20 hours a week and try to find another one to do that. So I don't know about that figure that was quoted about 2 million open jobs, but I think part of that is a significant amount of turnover in those jobs. Our clients who have those jobs, they're willing to leave them for another job making 25 cents more an hour. It's not a job that they keep for 20 years because it's not a job that really rewards that.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Ann. Says, I'd like to know your thoughts about teachers' unions. My own experience is that I'm a better teacher as a union member than when I was not in a charter school. Too often in a school, administrators don't consult with teachers and treat them as if they are students instead of colleagues. When sweeping generalizations have been made about my performance in the classroom by someone who has, has been in my classroom three times in the past 3 years and depends on students for gossip, the union is there to point out that the evaluation procedures in the contract aren't being followed. Mm-hmm. Lynn, I see you nodding your head there. Is that one of the kinds of protections that you try to emphasize when you're talking with potential union members?
Yes, we do. we try to stress that more than anything, you know, to let them know. You guys are human just like we are. And, you know, I know you have to take this so you can feed your family. I have to do the same. So, you know, we stress it.
We are talking about labor unions here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you much.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I apologize if any of this has been addressed because I had to stop for takeout. I'm on my way to work. 36-year member of UAW, a local factory in Indianapolis, which I won't name. There are a lot of fallacies over the years that have been projected by big business. One is, you know, they had to send jobs out of the country in order to compete. Whereas politicians should have stepped in and caused tariffs in place to stop a lot of that, because all they were doing was dumping cheap products on the market to try to get a foothold. And consequently, we're dealing with it now. But American businesses profited from those jobs going out of the country. Now the American businesses say that they don't have enough skilled labor in order to bring jobs back to this country. That's another fallacy, because the factory I work in and several big factories have operations in place that require nothing more than a person to stand there and push a button. And an average eighth grader could do the same job. And it's just madness. You know, they say they have these things, and it's a big lie. You know, a study done by this radio station 2-3 months ago said that the cost of living in Indianapolis, minimum wage, was $15 an hour. And I haven't heard anybody say minimum wages that were that much in the course of this conversation. It's going to turn around, and I have a question for your guest, the author.
Sure.
Why is it not possible, you know, we talk about, okay, the UAW going out on a strike or standing up for decent wages, and we talk about this union and this union. Why are these unions not in collusion with each other? Why does each union stand alone? Why not all unions stand together and bring things back up and stop making the rich rich? I've never understood that.
Let me try to get you an answer, Ron. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Ron. I think that part of the answer is that to the extent the law allows, I do think that unions oftentimes work together. We do have the AFL-CIO, which most of the unions in this state are actively involved, and that includes Unite Here. But the law is really on the side of those who want to blunt the power of the unions. There's something called secondary boycotts. And secondary boycotts are when, if somebody wants to show support for Lynn and her colleagues working for Aramark at Butler, and if they want to engage in a picket outside of Butler, or if they want to boycott something that Butler or Aramark is doing in another place, other folks connected to other unions are not allowed to do that. And that's a very significant limitation on what unions can do in terms of working together, in terms of increasing their own bargaining power in individual industries and workplaces. So a lot of folks who have asked for and pushed for the United States labor law to be changed highlight this prohibition on what's called secondary boycott, which prevents unions from really working together in many respects. Now, they do so in the political setting, and they do so in some lobbying efforts. But in terms of an individual workplace effort, there's a lot of handcuffs that are put on the union movement.
Have the ideas of secondary boycotts ever been tested in the court on First Amendment grounds?
They have not been, to my knowledge, at least taken very far up. It's actually, ironically, something that we're going to look into a little bit of research with a student I'm going to do soon. But Julius Gettman, a professor, actually was at IU for a while and now is at University of Texas Austin, one of the most respected labor law professors in the country, believes it is a First Amendment violation, that workers should be able to express themselves by supporting, and unions should be able to express themselves by supporting fellow unions and fellow workers. So it has not been struck down yet, but there's possibility of a challenge.
We are talking about the labor movement here on No Limits. We've got several calls. I'm going to try to get to them, but I'm going to ask both our callers and our guests, since we're getting close on time, to be concise in their answers. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi there. Quick question. Is it not been considered that when the minimum the minimum wage goes up, the companies are going to pass that on to the consumer, and the people who are getting the wages are the consumers. And aren't we going to be in the same position then all of a sudden with, you know?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Kathy.
Kathy, it's a pretty common concern, and you would think that would be what the case would be. But oftentimes, those costs are not passed on to the consumer because oftentimes there isn't a cost. It turns out when people get paid better, they stay at the job longer. They're more efficient on the job. Sometimes there's a small increase in the cost of the goods. But in reality, businesses have been shown, again, the raising of the minimum wage is the most studied question in economics. When the wages are raised at the bottom level, sometimes folks at the top aren't going to make as much. The place is more efficient. The economy is boosted, and so there isn't a huge amount of cost increase.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Greg. Says, anybody there care to elaborate on SEIU's fight in L.A. for $15 minimum wage and now pushing to exempt union companies from said $15 minimum wage? Sounds like a way for unions to collect more money to buy liberal politicians.
I'm not sure of that particular provision. I do know that SEIU has funded and supported the Fight for 15 across the country. I think it's been enormously successful in driving the conversation, in increasing the awareness of folks that maybe a dollar or two more an hour than minimum wage is not going to be enough to make a living wage.
Well, and you mentioned in the book, obviously, that the living wage number for Indianapolis is actually above the $15 that you talk. It's close to 18, right?
Correct, if it's a family of any particular size. And again, the Indiana Institute for Working Families has a self-sufficiency index to show what it is for any particular family member or family size and composition and in different counties across the state of Indiana. So it's more like for a single parent of two kids, for instance. Yes, we're talking about $18, $19 an hour.
So, Len, in terms of the campaign Unite Here has done for Butler, you mentioned you were being paid $7.25. What has the union activity managed to push your wage up to?
Well, right
now, if you're comfortable saying that.
Okay. Starting in September, I'll be at $9.50. So that's a lot better than $7.25, you know. So they really, you know, have been there a lot. So when we first started, you know, they gave us a 40-cent raise. You know, that's going to cover our dues and everything. It was 41 cents, actually. But, you know, that covered the dues. And then twice a year, I get raises. So
I'd like to thank both of my guests, Fran Quigley and Lynn Murphy. It's been a pleasure talking with both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. We'll be back on Thursday when we're going to talk about the Pew Center's new study on America's changing religious landscape. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.